This podcast is sponsored by Talkspace. Let's start 2026 with a hard truth. There's no perfect time to build the future you secretly dream of, and there's no time to waste. With support from a Talkspace therapist, you can make this the year you bravely go out and grab what you need from life, whether that's outer rewards or inner peace. Just go to Talkspace.com to be matched with a licensed online therapist. You can start messaging with your therapist right away and schedule live virtual sessions over video, audio, or chat. Your Talkspace therapist can help you create personalized strategies for making the changes and achieving the goals most important to you. Talkspace accepts most insurance with an average copay of $15, and most insured members have a $0 copay. No insurance? No problem. Get $80 off your first month with promo code SPACE80 when you go to Talkspace.com. Match with a licensed therapist today at Talkspace.com and save $80 with code SPACE80. That's SPACE80 at Talkspace.com.
The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance
on News Talk.
Now, quite often we see headlines splashed across the news with some great but possibly terrifying piece of medical news. And a recent example comes from a number of studies showing microplastics having been found in the human brain. But it appears that this may now be junk science. David Robert Grimes, disinformation expert and author of The Irrational Ape, joins us now. David, good morning and welcome.
Good morning, Pat.
Now, you're a bit of an expert on junk science.
That's a poison chalice to give myself, but yes, I am. A lot of my research focuses on research integrity. I look at why science is not done as well as it could be, and why a lot of the results that, you know, percolate in the public consciousness sometimes don't really pan out.
Now, there's a huge amount of what might be termed junk science, science that really does not stand the test of close scrutiny.
Absolutely. In the field of biomedical science, which is where I mainly work, about 85% of published research is deemed research waste. Now, what that means is it's either not well described enough for other scientists to replicate, or the experiments they're doing aren't well designed enough to answer their own research question. So we have a huge problem with that, and that can cause issues later on. For example, in cancer research, the field I used to work quite a lot in, about 89% of landmark preclinical studies, that is the stuff we use to inform what we're going to test next, fail to replicate, which means only 11% do. And this is a huge problem, which means a lot of the papers we read, we have to read with a huge grain of salt.
Now, talk to me about this replication. Is it only replicated or attempted to be replicated after someone publishes a paper claiming X, and only after its publication does the world at large know that someone has declared X, and it's at that point they start to replicate, by which time X may have a lot of traction?
Absolutely. So this is a thing called the Proteus phenomenon, which a collaborator of mine, John Ioannidis, described years ago. Early research is very amorphous, as in you'll find in a new field, the results are wildly divergent. They'll find something does work and then it doesn't work. And eventually, over time, this often crystallizes to solid science. Science is always building on provisional truths. So a lot of the early things we find, we realize the experiment wasn't done right, or there was something that invalidated the results. And that's science proceeding as it should. What sometimes happens, though, is a very sexy novel headline or finding grabs headlines because it's shocking. And even though that's superseded by science itself in a process of replication and self-correction, it often kind of sticks in the public mind because the original finding was very shocking, or seemed very shocking.
And of course, that famous vaccination story is a classic case.
Yeah, we've talked a lot about Andrew Wakefield's 1998 Lancet paper, where he made a false link between vaccination and autism. And even though that has been debunked numerous times over the intervening decades, it's still believed. About 20% of the population still believe there's some truth to it. And that's a real problem when, again, inside the confines of academia, we read papers knowing that they're provisional, knowing that they're sometimes kind of nonsense. Or, I mean, in my own field, I'll read papers by certain groups and go, I don't trust a word of that. I think they've, you know, done that the wrong way. Whereabouts, when this gets out into the public, you know, understandably, the public don't necessarily have those tools, and things can live a lot longer than they probably should have.
Now, sometimes it's good scientists with the best of intentions who inadvertently get it wrong. And one of these areas is the area of microplastics.
Microplastics, yeah. Now, you will have seen a huge headline last year. In 2025, there was a claim that they were looking at cadavers and the brains in them, and that there was a huge increase in the amount of microplastics they were finding in human brains between 1997 and 2024. Made headlines everywhere. I think it was covered all over Irish media as well. But that paper has been criticized as an absolute joke. I'm quoting some of the researchers, and some saying it's a bombshell situation. These studies are very much nonsensical. And there's a lot of technical reasons for that, but it turns out the methodology these scientists were using couldn't distinguish between fat in brain tissue and a very common plastic. And again, there's a lot of this stuff. It's not just this study. A lot of the microplastics ones, which are causing a lot of panic, and I get a lot of questions about them, have since turned out to be using methods that aren't appropriate. And other scientists have come out now and said these are kind of nonsense. The Guardian did a very deep dive on this recently. Now, again, we've been talking about microplastics for some time. Back in 2017, I was invited over to Berlin to talk to the European scientists about the level of risk for microplastics. And we found that there wasn't enough information for it, but there was no obvious signs of harm from it, because plastic is in our environment a huge amount. But recently, those fears have gone massively accelerated due to large studies like this, which get a lot of media traction, but may not be reliable. And in this case, don't appear to be reliable.
Now, the methodology here, when you're trying to detect these microplastics, you're looking for a signal from the material that it contains a microplastic. So what they do, the technique is to vaporize the stuff and then test it for the presence of polyethylene or whatever it might be. But it turns out fat in the brain, when vaporized, is detectable as a plastic.
Absolutely. Now, correct me if I'm wrong, Pat, but were you once a chemical engineer back in the day?
Back in the day.
So PYGCMS is the technique. Now, don't ask me what that stands for. But yeah, you're absolutely right. It's vaporizing samples to find fingerprints from the fumes that might indicate what was in it. The problem, as we've just discussed there, is it doesn't distinguish between very common plastics and fat. And it turns out your brain is over 60% fat. So the so-called rising levels of microplastics may just have been that brains get fattier as obesity goes up. There's also other methodological problems. And again, the problem is you get a lot of knee-jerk reactions to this. Because that study wasn't reliable but got a lot of traction, you could lead, you know, to misguided regulation. People panic and then regulators panic on top of it. But we've also seen that feed into a lot of very common misinformation. You and I talk a lot about health misinformation. Currently, if you go onto Instagram or TikTok, you will find unproven blood cleaning services, which go for up to £10,000 sterling, where they claim they will wash microplastics out of your blood and brain. Now, these are absolutely crazy and unsupported by evidence, and these people are grifting, but they're doing so because they're exploiting a fear that was, you know, in the public domain due to, largely to bad research.
Now, the other element of the research which can lead to a wrong conclusion is the presence of contaminants, because you're looking for tiny, 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 tiny particles. And therefore, if people haven't, if you like, made sure that their surfaces, their containers are free of these tiny, tiny, tiny microplastic contaminants, then the study's flawed.
Absolutely. And also the other way things can be flawed can be due to poor statistical methods. And that's one of my other areas of research. And unfortunately, that's very, very common in papers. To put it in context, there's also a darker reason. Now, I'm not saying this is for this group, but this certainly happens. In biomedical science, about 4% of papers contain some evidence of data or image manipulation, all of which is basically academic fraud. But that's 1 in 25 papers will deliberately engineer their results. A lot more people just screw things up because scientists is done by people. And again, scientists are people. And that means it can be very, very flawed. Also, I need to point out that academics are under huge pressure in a thing that we call publisher perish pressure, which is to sustain their positions, to sustain new grants. They have to keep finding results. And journals seem to prefer a big scary finding or a big interesting finding than you saying very diligently, we did this experiment and we found nothing. Even though if I find out that drug X, for example, doesn't work, that's as useful as knowing that it does work. A journal is more likely to publish a paper saying that the drug does work because that's more interesting to their readership. And unfortunately, these things lead to a thing called publication bias. And because scientists around the world are competing for limited resources, there has unfortunately been an explosion in publications. Last year, there was about 5 million scientific articles published. Now, go back 10 years and there was less than a million. So there's been a huge increase. And unfortunately, the quality hasn't gone up, congruent to that. So that's an issue too.
All right. And I presume we in the media are helping to contribute to this because, you know, miracle drug stops this disease or that disease is a great headline. Tests on a new drug reveal nothing is not such a great headline, is it?
Absolutely. But I have to defend journalists a bit. Years ago when I started doing public talks on this, I really had a go at journalists and sub-editors for you know, oversexing results. But then when actually people looked at this and said, where are these misleading representations coming from? They were coming from the press releases from the university, and more specifically, they were usually coming from the principal investigator of the group. So again, that was a scientist, usually quite a distinguished one in the group, who had a vested interest in getting this narrative out there because it got attention for their research. So while we can blame journalists, I mean, the buck also stops with us academics, who should be more careful and more nuanced about the findings we put out there into the public domain, because they can be misunderstood. And also, we shouldn't be contributing to that misunderstanding.
David Robert Grimes, thank you very much.
Thank you, Pat.
The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance
on News Talk.